नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Hare Krishna. This morning we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th Canto, Chapter 72, The Slaying of the Demon Jarasandha, Texts 12 through 14. We'll chant 12 together. Word meaning, Sri Shuka Uvacha, Sri Shuka said, Nishamya, hearing Bhagavat, of the Supreme Lord, Gitam, the song, Gita, leave, alu, ala, ula, blossoming, mukha, his face, ambuja, lotus like, without seeing his brothers, dip, of all directions, vijaye, in the context, ayunta, engaged Vishnu, of Lord Vishnu paid him with the potency of Brahm Sukham for the Vishuddhi Vacha Nishamya Bhagavad Gitam Gita Kola Nisham Vija Ratrim Vijayasta Vishnu Pedro Padrim Hikam Vishnu Vata Vishamya Bhagavad Gitam Gita Puran Hikam Vida Ratrim Vidyayasa Vishnu Pedro Padrim Hikam Vishnu Pedro Padrim Hikam Vishnu Pedro Padrim Hikam Vishnu Pedro Padrim Hikam Vishnu Pedro Padrim Vishnu Pedro Padrim Hikam Translation, Sukadeva Goswami said, upon hearing these words sung by the Supreme Lord, King Yudhisthira became joyful, and his face blossomed like a lotus. Thus he sent forth his brothers, who were empowered with Lord Vishnu's potency, to conquer all directions. He sent Sahadeva to the south with the Srinjayas, Nakula to the west with the Matsyas, Arjuna to the north with the Kaitayas, and Bhima to the east with the Madrakas. After defeating many kings with their prowess, these heroic brothers brought back abundant wealth for Yudhisthira Maharaj, who was intent on performing the sacrifice. 18. Report. Srila Prabhupada writes, it may be noted that by dispatching his younger brothers to conquer in different directions, King Yudhisthira did not actually intend that they declare war with the kings. Actually, the brothers started for different directions to inform the respective kings about King Yudhisthira's intention to perform the Rajasuya sacrifice. The kings were thus informed that they were required to pay taxes for the execution of the sacrifice. This payment of taxes to Emperor Yudhisthira meant that the king accepted his subjugation before him. In case of the king's refusal to act accordingly, there was certainly a fight. Thus, by their influence and strength, the brothers conquered all the kings in different directions, and they are able to bring in sufficient taxes and presentation. These are brought before King Yudhisthira by his brothers. Om Agyanatamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakamanandashyakam Srimad Bhagavatam, such a wonderful benediction from all of us, Srila Prabhupada has given to us. Because we get a look through the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam of a different world than that in which we live. These verses today could be skipped over very easily. It's transitionary from one aspect of the story to the next. But if we stop to take a look at what these verses offer us, it's quite startling, actually. As I said, we see a different world through these verses. When I was coming to the Krishna Conscience Movement, I purchased from the UDP mail order a poster. It's a poster of Lord Chaitanya going through the Jayakanda forest. And in that poster, in the background, there were deer and there were tigers. I had a friend come over to my house, and when they saw that poster, if they weren't so inclined, I'm sure most of us, many of us, have had the experience, we start becoming a devotee of Krishna, that our friends somehow or another become alienated from us in one way or another. So this person, although he was my friend, he took the opportunity to criticize the painting, saying that it was unrealistic that a tiger and a deer were in such close proximity to each other, because they're natural enemies. And the tiger would be pouncing on the deer and eating up the deer. Well, that's one way to look at the world. And that's the way that most people, conditioned souls in this world, do look at it. They look at it as a dog-eat-dog world, where one living entity is free from another. There's a verse like that. Talks about the different types of living entities, or four-legged people, something such as food, and for two-legged people, such as food. But the conclusion is, jivo jivasya jivanam, that one living entity is food for another. We eat each other up in one way or another, maybe not literally, but certainly that's the experience in the business world, to defeat your competitor, your rival in various ways. That's one way to look at the world. But Srimad Bhagavatam gives us another way to look at the world. And that's illustrated in these verses today. We get a look at what is a type of innocence that is absent from the other book of the world. So let me give you some examples from the text itself. In text 12, we have King Yudhisthira having his face blossom like a lotus upon hearing some acknowledging and thanking words from Lord Sri Krishna. His response to that is that his face blossoms like a lotus. Such innocence in his heart. I mean, Maharaj Yudhisthira at this point is not a naive person. He's not an inexperienced person in the world. He's experienced a lot of difficulty in his family life, intrigue in the royal court, personal anxieties and sufferings, austerities he had to perform. He's not an inexperienced person. Yet his face blossoms like a lotus. What does that mean? It means there's such an innocence in his heart that when he heard the words of Krishna, his response was such joy that it sprang from his heart and it showed on his face, and his face blossomed like a lotus. That's his innocence, despite his knowledge. And he's given all these wonderful prayers saying why he wants to do the Rajasuya sacrifice, which is to glorify Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's not an unknowledgeable, simple person. He's sophisticated in all ways. Yet he has such innocence that his face blossoms like a lotus in hearing the words of Krishna. I feel very fortunate that I actually saw such an occurrence. Someone's face blossoming like a lotus many years ago. I was, at that time, the secretary of Sakyut Maharaj, and this was, I think, around 1978 or 1979. We were visiting Philadelphia, and at that time there was a Gurukul in Philadelphia. And Pashupati's daughter, Madhava, she comes occasionally down to visit here. She was in the Gurukula. And when we came into the room where she and other young girls were there, I noticed her face, Madhava's face, and when she smiled in reception to Satyut Maharaj and other leaders of the Gurukula coming into the room, her face actually blossomed like a lotus. It physically changed with the smile. It was just like a flower. Blossom. So this blossoming of the face, we associate with the innocence of a child. At least I do. That was my experience with the innocence of a child. With the innocence of a child. It's hard to see some hardened, scarred, distrusting person of the material world having their face blossom like a lotus no matter what happens. It just doesn't happen in society because people are so beaten down by the onslaught of miseries of material nature. But at least we could expect to see it in a child's face. And there it was on Madhava's Those are just blossoming like a lotus. But again, that's something we that's the type of innocence that we expect of a child. But in Bhagavad culture, when there's knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there is a type of innocence that pervades one's heart that we can see this being a perfect example of. You're in a royal court, yet such innocence as this face blossoms like a lotus flower. So that's one example of the type of innocence that we find among the devotees of the Lord. Now, of course, we all have our favorite dear devotee of the Lord, Srila Prabhupada, and there are extensive descriptions of him and how he displayed this childlike innocence in interacting with the devotees. Particularly, he came to America where Kali Yuga is more advanced, more material miseries, more sad people, as they say, leading lives of quiet desperation. And yet, Prabhupada displayed such innocence that it sometimes shocked his young followers. So I want to read from some instances that happened in this regard. When Srila Prabhupada told a group of devotees how he first saw snow in New York City and thought the buildings had been whitewashed, some of his disciples could hardly believe that Prabhupada was actually so innocent. But by his mercy, he came to see this innocence as his non-deceptive Krishna-conscious beauty. What a wonderful statement. By his mercy, he came to see this innocence as his non-deceptive Krishna-conscious beauty. Everyone in this world, they say, it's a dog-eat-dog world. We're anxious to deceive, defeat our competitors, and we perceive everybody as a competitor. But the devotees could see the innocence and non-deceptive Krishna conscious beauty of Prabhupada. He didn't come to trick us or take anything from us. He came to give himself to us in a very innocent way, and it was perceptible by the devotees. Prabhupada's innocence is not only what Srila Prabhupada said, it is his freshness of expression, his outlook, such as when he wrote of his Guru Maharaj, "The line of service is drawn by you. The line of service as drawn by you is pleasing and healthy like morning dew." Poetry is a language of the heart. And a poet who can affect you by his or her words, by giving a meaning, something meaningful to the heart, and beyond that, then they're an effective poet. So this line of poetry that Prabhupada wrote about his spiritual master, reflecting appreciation of the innocence of spiritual life, is very wonderful. Here's another example of Prabhupada's innocence. And I think Mother Narayana mentioned it in one of her talks here, but quite amazing to hear still. Under Krishna's protection, Srila Prabhupada lived in the material world in a simple way and was never corrupted or tainted by it. He often appeared to be like an innocent young boy. He once asked his disciples, Nandarani and Dayananda, if they could adopt him as their son as a strategy to get permanent residence in the United States. This much. If we consider innocent, to mean not guilty, then Srila Prabhupada was certainly innocent of any material entanglement. Unlike most people, he lived in the world without implication by karmic reactions. And just one more, which very clearly puts one against the other, the material viewpoint and the spiritual viewpoint. He, referring to Prabhupada, also referred to all his devotees as innocent boys and girls. Prabhupada once used this phrase, innocent boys, during a public lecture in Compton Square Park. Allen Ginsberg was present with some of his friends, and he laughed sarcastically at Prabhupada's remark. Ginsberg was so decadent that the concept of innocent boys was something beyond him. For a person like Ginsberg, innocent boys often implies victims to one's sense gratification. Prabhupada's disciples, however, were innocent of sinful life by chanting Hare Krishna in the Prabhupada's direction. Therefore, it is not impossible that innocence can prevail in this world. When one becomes a devotee, he can remain innocent of further guilt and sinfulness, and he will not be corrupted. So not only does this innocence exist, and indeed the spiritual life is made of it, but just by recognizing that innocence of a pure devotee, we can ourselves come to the position of seeing the world in this very uncorrupted way. It's quite exciting when you think about it that we have this opportunity to have a different type of life, to see the world differently than most people. So innocence. There are further examples here. In the 14th verse here, Maharaj Yudhisthira is described as Ajatasattva. His enemy was never born. You have to be an innocent, pure-hearted person to be called Ajatasattva. That your enemy was never born. That when people interact with you, they recognize the purity in your heart and don't respond to it in an envious way to try to take what you have or take advantage of you. Maharaj Yudhisthira could never be taken advantage of, not because people didn't try to take advantage of him. Certainly, his cousins, the Kauravas, did try to take advantage of him and harm him in so many ways, but the purity of his heart, the innocence of his heart, prevented any of those attempts to be successful. And for those that were more open-minded, more part of the Bhagavad culture, there was never any envy or enmity between them and Maharaj Yudhisthira. And what's the prime example of that? That this person was a Jatashatra, his enemy was never born. But we needn't look any further than just his brothers. Five brothers were married to one woman. Maybe unfortunately, but we all can. Imagine the rivalry, the envy that can exist when one woman has five husbands. It's quite amazing that those brothers were able to live together without tearing each other apart or feeling envy and possessiveness in that situation. I mean, how many people just think this is mythology because it's so foreign from our experience in this terrible material world we live in? It's not. It's reality. They live like that because of the innocence given to them by being the devotees of the Lord. They viewed the world differently, so therefore they were able to live without enmity throughout their lives. Indeed, all of the activities of the Pandavas show this Bhagavat culture more than showing just ordinary material life in the world today, or even the morality of the Dharma of Vedic culture. I was surprised the other day, my wife and I were discussing as we drove home from the temple after hearing Nagaraj Prabhu's class, where he was explaining this point that was given in the Srimad Bhagavatam, that Yudhisthira Maharaj wanted to show, his purpose in doing the Rajasuya sacrifice is wanting to show that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Somehow or another, in the back of my head, it had always been rolling around that his purpose was more dharmic, to establish dharma or something like that. But it's not just dharma. He wanted to establish Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He wasn't just doing some good pious deeds by performing the Rajasuya sacrifice or any of the activities he did. He was acting as a servant, as a Vaishnava, a servant of the Supreme Lord. So as they were Vaishnavas, as they saw themselves as servants of the Lord, therefore they could live in ways which are inconceivable to the materialist. And that's demonstrated by them having five brothers that we've seen in my life. Now, it's not that it was without difficulty that they lived in this way. And probably the biggest test was at the vicious assembly when there was an attempt by Dushasana to trick Draupadi naked in the assembly. Yudhisthira got them into that situation. Yet the four Pandava brothers, not devoid of prowess, here in these verses are described, and we'll talk a little bit more about it in a minute, about the prowess they displayed to win the wealth for the Rajasuya sacrifice. It's not that they were without prowess, but in that assembly, following their brother, they restrained themselves from retaliating against the Kauravas, and it's one of my favorite quotes in tapes and everything that goes around about Mahabharata, why they didn't respond with violence against the Kauravas at that point. And the quote is, bound by the cords of virtue. They were bound by the cords of virtue. Who's bound by the cords of virtue? We're bound by the cords of virtue in our loyalty to Srila Prabhupada, in our loyalty to ISKCON, in our service. We're bound by these things. We're happily bound by them. It's not that innocence means that you just do anything and everything. We're bound by the cords of virtue happily. It's hard at times, yes, just like especially Dean. He found it very difficult to restrain himself in addition to somebody, but he did so for a higher purpose. Accepting that in a very innocent way, accepting his role in an innocent way. He's the servant of his brother, his elder brother. So this attitude of cooperation, Prabhupada termed it cooperation. He also asked us to do that. How your love for me will be shown how you cooperate after I'm gone. Sometimes that cord of virtue is difficult to wear. But we wear it out of the innocence in the heart that we accept that, yes, I should do this. This would be good for me This is what my spiritual master wants of me. And we see it actually in our devotees. I think one of the most charming photographs of Srila Prabhupada I ever saw was actually a shot of Srila Prabhupada from behind. And it was in Hawaii, and Prabhupada was doing as he used to do. He would take the flowers that were offered to him, he would throw it out to the crowd and devotees chanting. And so there's a picture of all people, of our dear God brother, Guru Kripa Prabhu. Now those of you that know Guru Kripa, and he was like a marine, he was like a Gautama Das guy. But when Prabhupada is throwing the flowers out, it catches his hand like that and flowers in the mid-air. And there, rough and tough and gruff, Guru Kripa has this innocent, boyish look on his face of amazement, just waiting for the mercy of Srila Prabhupada in the form of those flower petals. You should really see this picture. If you know Guru Kripa, take it from me. If you don't know Guru Kripa, he's, as I said, rough, tough, and gruff on the outside. Inside, he's something different. It's very soft. And it came out in this innocent looking picture. But he has this innocent look of expectancy on his face to receive those flower petals from Srila Prabhupada. It works, my dear Prabhu. If we take this Krishna consciousness in our heart, it changes us. We can become innocent inside from our heart, and we can see the world in a different way. We can see people in a different way. We can act in a different way. It works. Now, in the 14th verse also, there's a description of the brothers and how they were able to conquer this world. Well, the Sanskrit word is ojasa, by their personal strength or by their prowess. Now this word ojasa, let me give you some meanings of it that are found in Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. By my energy, by prowess, by strength, with great force, resounding voices, very forcefully, very fiercely, with our faculties, by their personal strength, by strength, with force. This is what's meant by ojasa. Now, I think that we can understand that it's a manifestation of the mode of passion, isn't it? I mean, when you see great energy and great endeavor being displayed, it's often coming from the mode of passion. And the Kshatriyas, as they go and conquer the world, obviously, they are ordinary Kshatriyas, they're compelled by the mode of passion in the fighting. I mean, if you're a Brahmin and you're just sort of passive by nature, the battlefield is not a place for you because it's a ferocious atmosphere which requires a display of great display of energy. And one thing that we know from studying the modes of nature from Bhagavad Gita that along with very passionate displays comes attachment. Attachment to the fruit of what you're doing. It sort of comes along with it. But here we see the Pandavas, brothers, they went out at the head of armies. Each of them had an army. Sahadeva had an army of the Sunjayas, Nakula had the army of the Matsyas, Arjuna had the army of the Kekayas, and Bhima had the army of the Madrikas. They were at the head of an army. And they were given a task which would require them to fight. So how is it that despite the natural attachment that comes in that kind of situation of display of passion, how come it didn't affect them And they were so easily able to come back and to just deliver the wealth to Yudhisthira. Arjuna is not credited for performing the Rajasuya sacrifice. Bhima is not credited for performing the Rajasuya sacrifice. Neither are Sahadeva and Nakula. Yudhisthira is credited for performing the Rajasuya sacrifice. But who did the work? Who got the money? And how did they get it? By taking an army and marching all over the world. That's how they got it. Yet, it wasn't ordinary expressions of the mode of passion. Because if it was, how could they be so detached to come back and just give the money, give all the tribute to Yudhisthira, to do as he liked? It said they brought back abundant wealth to King Yudhisthira, who was intent on performing the sacrifice. Yudhisthira was intent on performing the sacrifice, not the other brothers. Yudhisthira got the credit for performing the sacrifice. But because this was to glorify Krishna, because that was the purpose, and they were working in conjunction with that purpose, they weren't attached. They weren't attached. That attachment did not arise as it normally does. You may know, I don't know if you know or not, but even in the history of the United States, recent history of the United States, there was an example of a great general that basically got carried away with his power to the point where the president of the United States had to remove him from his position. This idea of fighting is so, and I'm the Lord is so pervasive. It's not just something that we talk about. Duryodhana and others had that. No, right in our own history, 50, 60 years ago, Douglas MacArthur became so carried away with his victories as a general that he wanted to wage war outside the authorization of the President of the United States. The President had to say, yank his chain, wait a minute, I'm in charge here, not you. So this kind of response is natural when you're at the head of an army, engaged in a passionate activity of fighting. Then attachment comes, but the Pandava brothers didn't have that arise in them because their purpose was to serve and glorify the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So these verses, they give us a different view of the world. And if we read Srimad Bhagavatam, we study Srimad Bhagavatam, then we can start to see it. We can start to enter into this different type of a life. It's a life that offers us a lot more than our engagement in this material realm. I just want to finish with one thing that's sort of like our duty in this regard. How to protect the innocent in our own hearts and especially in our children. Bhagavan Prabhu gave me this book called Defeating Vatsasura, A Guide to Protecting Childhood Innocence. Schools are about ready to begin here in our community. And so, I think it's important to remind adults as well as the children of the necessity to, as it says here, protect the innocence that's there in our hearts once it is evoked. And so, Pityavardhana Prabhu, who's worked with the Bhaktivinoda Academy in Mayapur, he quotes here from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur from an article called Bhakti Sura. The king of the atheist counts is always setting the demon Vatsasura to corrupt and destroy the boys. The teacher of the young employed by the atheistic society is verily the agent of King Kamsa. The atheist is afraid lest the boys are employed in the service of Krishna. He is naturally anxious to prevent any acquaintance of the boys with Krishna. But if a boy has really found Krishna, the nefarious attempts of the empiric teacher are powerless to destroy his innocence. Such a teacher preserves in the fruitless, perseveres. If such a teacher perseveres in a fruitless attempt, he will thereby quickly bring his own utter moral degradation, and his sorry trick will also be fully exposed. Because in this case, it is Krishna himself who exposed the wicked activities on behalf of his protege. Vatsasura was one of the demons slain by the boy Krishna. He represents the evils that are peculiar to boyhood. The neophyte is extremely susceptible to such evils. They cannot get rid of except by the mercy of Krishna. If one engages in the service of Krishna, the juvenile vices are completely eradicated at an early stage. So our boys and girls have been given to us by Krishna, by Kunti children, and they're given to us with a certain innocence that we are duty-bound to protect. So as we invite and receive back the students, what day is it? It was Tuesday last year. I think it's changed this week. What day will it be coming? Does anybody know? Huh? Monday? The day they come in the temple. Is it the Tuesday again this week? Those are special days here, you know, the children are here. So we should all take it as our responsibility as a community to protect the innocence that is displayed by these young children and young devotees of Krishna. Hare Krishna, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.